Well, thank you, Debbie, for the introduction. Just want to thank you guys for coming out today to hear what I have to say. And also wanted to thank the American Homebrew Association for allowing me this opportunity to share my experiences with you. It's really terrific to be able to come up here and give a little talk. And it's fantastic you guys are interested in what I have to say. As Debbie was saying,
I did the arrows. Technical difficulties. Stand by. There we go.
All right. So I just want to talk a little bit more about myself because I consider myself an expert in the topic. I'm the head cellarman of the NARAX Festival, the New England Real Ale Exhibition, and it's really where I learned the bulk of this knowledge about cask ales. And what it is it's the longest-running real ale festival in the country. I get the opportunity to work with between 60 and 100 different firkins over a four-day festival. It's a very traditional English-style festival. One of the advantages I have as the head cellarman for the organization is it's my duty and responsibility to taste the beer before we serve it every session to decide what's worth serving, what is not worth serving. And I did the math back of a envelope or something, and it turns out that I've tasted over 1,000 different samples of cask ale. I don't say that to impress you with my drinking ability. I share it with you as just a fact that says that I've had the opportunity to taste beer as it ages over the course of a festival, which is great. Ooh, the clicker.
Sorry.
And... oh, disco. Nice. All right, so when I was becoming the head cellarman of the organization, they actually have a scholarship program, which homebrewers from across the country are welcome to apply for. We actually send people over to the Great British Beer Festival over in London. This is, of course, the home of cask ale, and the Great British Beer Festival is the largest real ale festival that they put on. I participate in what's called bar management training, and what that is not just the mechanics of how you serve the beer, but also the planning behind the event, how you place your orders and structure your volunteers and take care of all the details of that. And that was terrifically helpful. Most importantly, I consider myself a home brewer. I'm one of you guys. I love making my own session ales at home, something you don't get out of breweries all that frequently. And because I'm a home brewer, my approach to cask ale is very different than a professional brewer or a publican would approach it. I'm coming at it with the same problem-solving mentality that you all do as you approach your own recipe design or beer brewing process. And I organized my own smaller all-homebrew cask festival called the May Day Cask Festival. Never actually falls on May Day, but it's still the beginning of May, and I tend to serve about, I'd say, 10 different beers on cask at that event, which is a lot of fun. All right. So what is cask ale? Cask ale is beer that is served slightly warmer than draft beer usually is. We're looking at 48 to 54 degrees Fahrenheit. And it also has a different amount of dissolved carbonation. That's the 1.1 to 1.3 dissolved volumes. This is a little bit different than what you go for when you're bottle conditioning beer, which is typically 2.5 dissolved volume. So it's much lower carbonation. And in order to be a cask ale, there's a certain way that it needs to be served. You can't push the beer around using gas, particularly CO2, because when you're pushing the beer with gas, there's always the chance that that gas is going to go into solution. And that's what the English call extraneous CO2. You want to avoid that. So you do it mechanically. You have a beer engine, which is lifting the beer up to the point of dispense, or you're using a gravity tap where the beer is just falling into your glass. Camera, being British, they're slightly more persnickety about their definition. They prefer that the beer is not only brewed using the traditional ingredients, but it's carbonated in the vessel from which it is served. And I found that a little bit more restrictive, so I'm not using the true camera definition of real ale. Also, camera prefers their beer slightly warmer than me. They prefer the 11 to 13 degrees Celsius. It works out to about 52 to 57 degrees Fahrenheit. I find that to be a touch too warm, so I dial it back a little bit and I shoot for that 45 48 to 54 degree range. It's great to have definitions, but what is cask ale? Why are we doing it? Well, because it's served a little bit warmer and with less carbonation, there are a couple major changes that happen in the beer. Personally, I find cask ale to be more flavorful than your standard keg beer. And the reason it's more flavorful is that the beer is warmer, so you're getting more of those the interplay of the different malts. I'm sure as homebrewers, you've considered, should I use your standard American two-row malt, or should I go for the British malt? When you're working with cask ale, that change becomes a lot more pronounced. Because of the lower carbonation, the beer is a little bit less fizzy on the tongue as you're drinking the beer, as you're consuming it. And that has a couple different consequences. One of which is that the CO2 isn't there to lift those hop aromatics and just force them down your nose and be, hey, I'm hops. You don't have that as much because you don't have the carbonation level to warrant it. Some people say that makes the beer less aromatic. I like to say that it's a little less aggressively aromatic. I've still had very flavorful, very hop-forward beers, both from American and British brewers. They just have to be a little more subtle about it, which is the fourth point here, more subtle. You're getting a little bit more interplay in the malts. You get to taste the hops a little bit more. Making cask ale is a lot of fun because small differences have outsized impacts on the beer you're producing. And as I mentioned, I'm a big fan of the session ales. Those are the lower alcohol beers, so I can actually have 3 or 4 pints of them. I thought it was a fun game on industry night 2 nights ago to try to find beers that were less than 5%. As you know, it was kind of challenging. But at the homebrew night, I'm very happy to report that I had 5 or 6 different cask ales, and they tended to be that lower alcohol that I prefer so I could enjoy them and still be able to talk today. There we go. All right. So what about real ale in general? Newsflash. You guys are already experts at making real ale. All that bottle-conditioned beer that you do, that's real ale. The key component is that the yeast is giving you the carbonation that you're using in the beer. So you're not force carbonating it. It's all in an enclosed environment, the yeast digesting that sugar, giving you the CO2. What cask ale is a slightly smaller subset, which is more specific about the way that the beer is being served. That's where you get the casks in cask ale. All right, the kind of vessels that we can use as homebrewers. We have the 5-liter mini keg. You might see this in your local homebrew store. You might see it on the store shelf pre-filled with beer. They actually make a pretty decent a cask. And the reason they work well is they have the hole in the top to let the gas in, and they have a tap, not pitchered, to allow the beer to fall out of the bottle. And you've probably seen in the bar a pin or a firkin. These are 4.5 and 9 UK gallon vessels, respectively. They're about the size of a corny keg and a half barrel keg that you get from a brewery. They're terrific to work with. Breweries use them all the time. And in my experience, they're definitely the easiest thing to do. But not everyone has the money to invest in those, and so you can use a corny keg. Corny kegs are great for the same reason they're great for doing regular carbonated homebrew in. You have the access port at the top to get the beer in and out. You have the separated liquid in and gas outsides. You can use it with a beer engine the same way you would with a firkin or a pin to pull the beer out of the vessel and serve it. There's also a way to serve using the corny keg, kind of oddly focused, like tilted on its side, 45 degrees or so. And I find that silly, so I don't recommend it. But it can be done. And essentially, you reverse it so that the beer is coming out the gas port, so it has the very short dip tube, and then you're allowing gas in the liquid side, so the gas is traveling to the bottom of the keg and allowing the headspace to fill with gas as you remove the liquid volume. You can also use these. These are a German-style keg. The Germans also have a tradition of cask ale, particularly in the Franconia region. This is called a Franconian gravity keg. In the U.S., I've only seen it from one distributor, and they are very difficult to get. But they also work. I'd just like to point out that this German design is pretty much the same thing you get with the 5-liter mini keg. They have a venting hole at the side that you can't see because of the pitcher, but it has the tap in the bottom that allows the beer to fall out into your glass. And you can also use your standard Sankey keg. The coupler doesn't really matter, but kind of like that corny keg, the important thing is that you can separate the gas coming into the headspace and the liquid coming out of the vessel. One of the problems with using the Sankey kegs, though, is that the dip tube is fixed, so you're always drawing off the bottom of the vessel. If you're very familiar with the beer and can clear it out, it'll work fine. If it's another beer, lots of yeast sediment in it, it's not going to work as well. But it does actually work for cask when you're using a beer engine. And finally, there are polypins. Polypins are a little different in that they collapse as you serve them. This is the same technology that is used in the wine bag in a box. So as you're serving the beer, the container is actually collapsing. And what that does is it allows the entire atmosphere to serve as the pressure to push the beer out as it collapses. The only downside of the polypins is that they're a little finicky to work with because they only have the single inlet and outlet port. And it doesn't allow any of the atmospheric oxygen to get at the beer to evolve those beer flavors. So you don't get the evolution, but you can serve cask ale for weeks at a time, and it's still good. So that's also an option for you. Two ways to serve, I mentioned a couple times. You have the gravity. That's your standard. You pop the tap in the bottom. Gas goes in the inlet port here. And very simple. You can also do it with a beer engine. Pitch it on the side of the slide. And here's one in action. It has a very classic pull. There's just something about going to a bar or operating it yourself, and you're physically pulling the beer and allowing it to fall into your glass. I find it to be very refreshing. Basic principles of caring for cask. You're concerned with the temperature, which we talked about, 48 to 52 degrees Fahrenheit, 54 degrees Fahrenheit. The carbonation level, the clarity, the flavor, and then the amount of time that you're working with the beer, depending upon what your setup is. So for controlling temperature, you can put the beer into a cool environment. When I went to England, I had the chance to go into an actual English beer cellar, and as you can see, they are even messier than your homebrew closet. But it still has the beers. They're over here on the side. Those are the cask ales. All these lines are going up to the service floor above it using beer engines, so they're pulling those beers from down below up top, and they're controlling the temperature just by having that cool environment, subterranean. The other thing you can try is evaporative cooling. Water itself has a very high specific heat. As it evaporates at room temperature, it's absorbing energy to do that evaporation, and if you put a moist towel over your vessel, it'll absorb some of that energy out of the vessel, some of the heat out of the vessel, and you will get some evaporative cooling effects. This only works in rather dry environments. If you're in a moist, humid environment like we see a lot of times in the Boston area, this is not going to work for you. So another thing you can do is you get the beer down to temperature, you can insulate around the beer to make sure that the people who are coming to drink the beer, all their body heat doesn't get to the beer, so just a little insulative cover works wonders if you're serving on a very short time horizon, as long as the beer is already relatively cold. There's also ice blanketing. So this is a bucket of ice with more ice than we need because we're cooling it down, or you can use a slightly fancier, this is in the food service industry to keep food product cold. Either way, instead of using water, you're putting ice directly on it, which allows you to keep your beer cool. And then finally, there are the fancy cooling systems. They're a little more complex, they're a little more expensive, but they work that much better. This one here is a pin I hosted at my home, and you can see this copper tubing. It just goes around it. It has two connections here. excuse me. One goes to a ice bucket where it's pumping the cold water through, and it just creates a little cold environment, and you couple that with the insulation. I have a cask jack that fits over it, and you're keeping the beer cold that way. There are also internal cooling systems. I only saw these in use in England. And essentially what you do is you pop out your shive here, and you replace it with a cooler that goes into the vessel. So it's a piece of tubing like this stuff here. It goes down in and loops back and comes back out. And it works really efficiently because you're putting the cold part right into the beer. And those work really well, but like I say, I never see them in this country. Tied with the temperature of the beer, we have the carbonation, also referred to as the condition of the beer. Pretty much this chart says it all. Beer, or really any liquid, will hold on to a certain volume of CO2 just from, that's what it does, chemistry and whatnot. So as we're in the cellar temperature range I talked about, 48 to 54, these three right here, we're sitting at that 1.2 to 1.1 dissolved volumes, which is where you want to serve your cask-conditioned beer. Some strategies to control the carbonation. Obviously, you control the temperature, so it naturally wants to hold on to it. But you also need to manage the beer as it arrives at the hall. A lot of times, it will be overly conditioned. People want to make sure that people are always worried that the beer that they're giving you is going to be flat, so they add extra carbonation to it. So by venting early, that allows that excess condition, that excess carbonation, an opportunity to come out before you have to serve the beer. Managing that venting port is rather important. As you're serving the beer, you need to have the spile pulled out to allow atmosphere in as the volume of beer is removed. And at the end of the serving session, you want to remember to plug that hole up, because the beer will give up the CO2 due to the partial pressures of the atmosphere not having so much carbonation, so much CO2 in the mix. You can also take corrective action. I've done this a few times at a bar. It's bar top service. We're serving the beer in 1 hour, go. And that is, you vent the beer as best you can, but it's overcarbonated. So you do some strategies such as creating a slight vacuum, leaving your spile in, draining out some beer to create a vacuum in the headspace, and then you give it a couple smart raps with a screwdriver or your mallet. That encourages CO2 to come out of solution, so you can take corrective action that way. The one thing to keep in mind is that once your carbonation is gone, it's not coming back. So you always want to try to approach carbonation gently from the top side. You can't correct once the beer has gone flat. All right, so for controlling clarity, clarity is very important to me because I believe in that British tradition of bright beer. I know there are lots of great beers out there that have a little haze in them. If it's a wheat beer, if it's a rye beer, or if it's a sour beer where there's a reason for the haze, I can work with that. But if it's hazy just because the yeast haven't had a chance to settle out or the hops are still in suspension, that's going to impact the flavor of your beer, and that's why clarity becomes important. Controlling for temperature prevents chill haze from developing, so that one's pretty easy. You're at cellar temperature anyway. And the carbonation level. When you first breach the vessel and allow the headspace gas to escape, CO2 starts migrating up vertically to go out of solution, and that actually allows some of the finer particulate to start settling down to the bottom of the vessel, which is what we want. You can encourage the use of finings when you're having the vessels filled, be it a commercial brewer or a home brewer, gelatin, icing glass, biofine, any of those are great. Biofine in particular, it's a salicylic acid. It can be added to a cask right before you serve it. It only takes about an hour or so to settle out of solution, and it does a terrific job at settling yeast. So you can actually add finings right as you're getting the beer ready to serve. There's also the opportunity to serve vertically sometimes. That would be using a cask wedge or an ale extractor, and that allows you to chase down the bright beer because, like I mentioned, the cask wedge has a floating pickup, and you can also modify a corny keg. Take out your liquid dip tube, put in a gas dip tube, and put the same sort of floaty bit in it, and that just chases the bright beer down all by itself. The older technology called an ale extractor, you have to manually set the height, and so you have to adjust it a few times, but it still gets the job done. All right, so for controlling for flavor, as the cellarman, you do it, but you're working with the beer that the brewery or the home brewer is giving you. So you don't have a whole lot of control. Your job as the cellarman is to showcase the beer in the best possible light to make the brewer look good. That's what you're doing. And really all you have to do is don't contaminate the beer. With a service timeline of just a few days, that's usually not a big problem. But if the beer comes preloaded with a bunch of bacteria, there's not much you can do. You just try not to make the problem worse. You're also tasting the beer over time. Young beer is also called green beer. That's because it has an acetaldehyde type flavor. It tastes like a green apple. Try not to serve that beer. If you have time, let that beer work with a little bit of oxygen. Let the yeast that's still in the beer reduce that so that the beer tastes better. Because you're allowing atmospheric oxygen into the top of your vessel, you're going to get a little bit of oxidative staling. It's not going to go straight to that cardboardy stale flavor, but it actually improves the flavor of the beer over the first day or so of service. So it's really interesting to taste beer over time. And as I mentioned, you don't want to serve the beer that isn't ready, the green beer, and you don't want to serve that old beer. Sometimes you just have to pour the beer out. It's part of working with cask. So controlling time, you can't, unless you have one of these. They call it TARDIS. It's available in about 3 centuries, and you're never going to see one. But just keep in mind that you're working with time. It's one of the variables that, you're not really controlling. One of the variables you're working with. So keeping time in mind, we get back to the basic principles, temperature, carbonation, clarity, flavor, and time. And flavor is what we're working with. Temperature, carbonation, and clarity, those are the ones we have direct impact on. And time just kind of, time marches on, I suppose they say. So let's talk about a couple practical examples. I've been hitting you guys with lots of technical information. So this alphabet soup, I'll explain. We have the East Boston Open Mic Night. Essentially, one of my buddies has some people over to play instruments, and he likes to serve cask beer. Very simple setup, classic gravity technique. You have the New England Pro-Am Beer Festival. This is just a homebrew competition, not one of the ones where you're judging the bottles technically, but it's a People's Choice Award where people travel around and try a bunch of different beers, kind of like Club Night last night. Instead of just rolling in with a keg and serving through a jockey box, I like to mix things up and bring a little bit of cask ale to change it up, get a little bit of competitive edge there. Then we have the Extreme Beer Festival. That's a commercial beer festival in Boston. And a couple breweries give us some really interesting cask that we get to serve at that event. There's also the May Day Cask Festival. That's my little homebrew cask festival I mentioned. We're going to get to see that. It's neat because it's gravity and beer engine service. And I use a technique called Rack Bright to make sure that the beer is good. And, of course, we have the big show, NAREX, the New England Real Ale Exhibition, your classic English real ale festival. So here's open mic night. In this awful, awful picture, we have the cask here in the back, not very front and center, but it's the picture I had. And you can see it's just kind of sitting on this little board. There's the tap in the front. It's covered, so we're using evaporative cooling. And it's still using these wooden devices called chocks. So the chocks go into a three-point stance, which is very stable, and we position the cask upon that. Actually, the way it works is that you put the cask relatively in position, and then you use the chocks around it so that it stays in that serving position. You didn't see those in the picture, but they're under there holding the cask in place. It also has some ice on the top of that cask. It doesn't have to be fancy like those food service ice packs I was talking about. This is just a Ziploc bag stuffed with ice. And very cheap, very easy to use, and it works pretty well. And we covered that with a blanket, which we then kept wet, so we have a little bit of evaporative cooling in addition to the ice cooling effect. And what you don't see in this picture, among other things, is the open window right here. So we actually have a really nice breeze. And this tray is actually one of those dish drying rack trays, and it actually drains directly into a sink. So any condensation that built up, or any water that leaked out of the ice pack, just went right into the sink. Very easy. Now, the advantages were that it was a private room with a small bar, so there was plenty of time to set it up in advance of the event. So we had 2 days, kept it cool with the ice blankets and the evaporative cooling method. We vented a day before the event. We tapped it the morning of the event. Whenever possible, it's a good idea to separate your venting and your tapping to allow the yeast time to settle out. If you get good at tapping those kinds of pins or firkins, you can actually drive the tap in without disturbing a whole lot of yeast sediment. It's like the old trick, I'm not going to do it, but if I was good, I could whip this tablecloth right out and everything would stay in place. You can do the same thing driving a tap into a cask. And then finally, we had most of the beer was served in that beer engine in the front of the pitcher, but in the back, we only served about half of the firkin. So we went back 2 days later, and we polished the thing off, and the beer was in great shape. It helped that it was a vanilla stout. The vanilla is very very easy to work with because it absorbs a lot of the oxygen flavor, hides a lot of thing. And stout being a heavier beer, it was, again, very resistant to oxidative effects. So the New England Pro-Am Beer Festival, here are all the bits I've been talking about. Most important is my beautiful 4-pound dead blow hammer. Got this at the local import tool mart or whatever it was, but this thing is awesome. It knocks the woody bits, you know, these guys here, into position. And the dead blow part, that just means there are some steel beads rocking around in it. When you hit something, it stops dead. It doesn't have any bounce back, or it reduces the bounce back. So I definitely like the dead blow over, you know, even your traditional ash mallet. This here is part of my setup. You saw in the last event we used the chocks to keep the vessel still. This is just a little cradle. So I use these cut pieces of plywood, and I assemble a little device to hold the pin in place. That's my ice blanket. This is the tap, still in its plastic bag for reasons unknown. And the woody bits. Woody bits, these are your consumable items as you're working with these traditional English stainless steel vessels, the firkins and the pins. So there's my cask cradle all set up, and just drop the beer in it. Boom, ready to go. Nice and easy, doesn't move, the cask doesn't slide around at all. You're ready to go. So in order to serve beer on a very short time horizon, there's a technique that I like called racked bright. You guys are very familiar with doing this because you do it every time you bottle beer. You take a beer in your fermenter, give it a chance to rest, but move it to your tabletop, and then you rack the beer into your bottling bucket. Half the reason you're doing that is to leave behind all the trub, so when you mix in your priming sugar, you're not mixing in the gunk, the trub. So racking bright just means that you're taking all of the bright beer, all the beer that's ready to serve, and you're moving it into a temporary service vessel that you can then move to site and not worry about disturbing all of that sediment. It's very similar to thinking about filling a growler off of a tap. It works, it transports the beer to where you're going, but it doesn't require you to bring your whole kegging setup. The trick to doing rack bright beer, I like to use a corny keg. Of course, I'm using yeast to derive the CO2. I'm not force carbonating. That would be cheating. We do not do that in cask ale. And I just throw it in the, after it has had a week or so to carbonate, throw it in the kegerator, crash cool it, and then you just rack the beer into the pin. I have a 6-foot piece of line, 3/16. It slows down the transfer rate. I'm using a very low head pressure, about 4 or 5 PSI. Move the beer gently so that it holds on to the carbonation that it has. And one of the nice things is that in the service vessel, you're mixing it with the atmosphere, so you're getting a little bit of that oxidative flavor change, but there's not a whole lot of time for it to be dramatically bad. Like that growler we were talking about, you filled off your tap. In a couple days, that's not going to be good because of oxidative aging. In a cask situation, a little bit of aging can be a good thing. And one of the nice things is that it doesn't require a whole lot. I'm not lugging a CO2 tank around. I don't have my regulator. I don't have all the accoutrements. It's just the cradle, the vent, the tap, the cover, and, of course, my little pin. All right, so Extreme Beer Festival. This one's a little different. We have a bar that we've built up specifically for this purpose, and it's a gravity. So we're using the beer engines here, and you can see that the beer itself tucks very nicely underneath the bar. So here it is, same picture as before, a bunch of ice around it. This is a cask wedge. The body for an ale extractor looks very similar. And the thing is that you only are accessing the beer through this one port. So you pound it in, that's how you vent the beer out of the headspace. And then when you go to serve it, you take the top off, and it has that bit that extends down into the beer that you then draw from. And the beer engine is, of course, pulling that beer to your glass. I will note that this is an awful lot of ice for cask ale. We're only looking for that 48 to 54 degrees Fahrenheit. This was room temperature beer. We need to get down to that range, and then once we hit it, we actually remove a bunch of ice from it. And yeah, so a couple details. It's a very short horizon. We have 3 hours to set it up. So our priority is taking care of the beer. Ice down the beer, get down to that cellar temperature. Then, while the beer is cooling, that's when you take the time to build your bar. Once the bar is built, go back to the beer and start venting out that headspace, control for that carbonation level. And once you vent it, sometimes it takes a little time to vent, you install your beer engines on the bar. And then finally, you bring them both together by drawing the beer and testing it through the beer engine, of course. All right. So this is my little Mayday Cask Festival. This is the gravity side of things. The first time I did it, I had just one of these six-foot tables. I don't know if any of you guys had the opportunity to go to Philadelphia 2 years ago, but I actually convinced the club to do an all-cask presentation for Cask Night. It was pretty awesome. But what we learned was that with only an eight-foot service area for 10 different beers, we had very long lines. We couldn't turn people over. So this is the one that I did this year, and I used two tables just for gravity, and I actually put the beer engine service in a completely different section of the hall. But here it is. I use a bunch of cradles. Cradles are great. They hold the beer still. You can see the metal saddles that keep the beer cool, and it's all powered by this bucket of ice and water. I just have in there a little pond pump. It moves the cold water around, and the cold water travels through the saddles, cools down the beer. This is in the spring, so I don't need to do too much to cool it. I just throw my old wool blanket over it, and the whole thing is good. Cooling says power. Yeah, so pretty much all the stuff I just said in text form, in case you want to consult the slides later. I do prefer to allow the beer to pre-settle. So I was in, the venue was very close to my shop, and I was able to pre-settle, pre-vent the beer, vent in advance, and then carefully carry it over to the venue. Being homebrewers, some people showed up a little bit late, and their beer was racked bright because I didn't have enough time to allow it to settle quite the same way. All right, so here's the big show, NARAX. We are celebrating our 20th festival this coming spring, so if you ever need an excuse to travel to the Boston area, come this April, April 6th through the 9th, 2016, South Boston Lithuanian Club, narax.org. So anyway, our basic unit is a bay of stillage, which is, again, an 8-foot section of bar, but behind that bar we have a 8-foot high section of construction scaffolding. And that scaffolding we break into three different layers. We have two layers of five beers each that are served on gravity, and then the ones that are closest to the ground have some tubing that bring it around front to the beer engines. So we get 15 different beers on the stillage, and then we add to that the potential for three different beers underneath the bar, and then every once in a while we'll get one of those German beers, and instead of reserving a spot for it, you just throw it on the bar and start serving it. So we can actually serve 19 different beers from a single 8-foot section of stillage. And the Classic Festival, which is the one coming up in April, has 5 bays. So you can imagine 75 different beers, plus all the verticals, plus the Germans. We can serve a lot of beer at once. Being cask, we don't necessarily put them all on. We have to wait for the flavors to develop and for the beer to be in peak condition. So usually we serve about 40 or 50 different beers at each of the sessions. We also have a second festival called November. That's a little 3-bay setup. and the three bays of stillage holds 45 different beers, we only serve about 60 firkins over this event, so it works. The big challenge is keeping everything cool, and we use some commercial grade electric glycol mixes. And we have that built into a little stand. Wish I had a picture of it, but unfortunately I don't, so I'll describe it to you. Essentially, it's 2x4 technology, something I built. We have a chiller at the bottom, chills the bottom layer of the stillage. Then we have one that's about 3 feet off the ground, chills the second layer. And then we have the third one up high. And the reason we stack those vertically not only saves floor space, but now the pumps don't have to lift anything vertically. It's just pushing along on the same horizontal level, which helps improve their efficiency. So as I mentioned, it's a blend of gravity and engine service. Narax, we do not do any rack bright beer. It's all traditionally fined. And one of the reasons that we can do that is that it's a very long festival. We go weekend to weekend. And while we're paying for the venue for days that we don't have people in it generating revenue, it's worth it because the beer, in our opinion, is being done right and comes out with the best possible flavor. One of the interesting challenges of the festival is because it's so large and lasts for so long is we actually rotate different beers onto the stillage during it. So as beers are being kicked at the end of the night, we'll rotate some new stuff on. And to get it ready faster, we'll do a little bit of work to stage the beer so it's already sitting horizontally. We'll vent it on the ground and then very carefully lift it and put it into that spot on the stillage without disturbing the other beers that are there. All right, and a few other examples. Different casks I've done different places worth mentioning. You saw the picture of the pin at home. I just used a little igloo cooler as the ice reservoir, and that was the little copper saddle that you saw. Pretty easy to set up. A friend of mine, Lindsay, has an Oktoberfest party at her house because she's very proud of her German heritage. I like to roll in there with a rack bright pin and just use an ice blanket to keep it cool. Her birthday is in the fall, so usually I don't have to worry about an extremely hot day. It's just enough to put a little ice blanket on it and call it good. Kasktoberfest, another friend, a month later, would have a bunch of beer in his garage. Now, because this is later in October, one of the advantages is that his entire garage is cellar temperature. I don't need to worry about setting up any cooling systems for it. I can just use the natural environment. And one of the things we do at this event is we do a lot of serving out of corny kegs. And there's so much beer for a relatively small crowd drinking it that we try to preserve the beer by doing what's called gas blanketing. So in our corny kegs, obviously the beer is coming out of the liquid side. To the gas side, we connect up a CO2 manifold, just like if we were doing pushing out on draft. But I set the regulator, I pull the set screw all the way out so that it's not pushing any extra pressure in. And what happens is that as you're serving the beer, you're pulling it with the beer engine, you're creating an area of negative pressure, a slight vacuum inside the corny keg, and that's actually opening the manifold inside the CO2 regulator, and it's pulling a little bit of gas through. So you can actually blanket that way. One of the things you want to do is you don't want to use a beer gas mix, you only want to use pure CO2, because using a beer gas mix, you have a little bit of a partial pressure differentiation inside the inside your keg, and it'll actually pull a little bit of gas out, and we're trying to avoid that. So using straight gas, straight CO2, there's no reason for the gas to want to migrate out, and the beer will stay conditioned longer. All right. Last year, I took a break from doing my own Mayday Cask Festival. I did a commercial version of it at a bar, and the reason that I want to mention it is that instead of having my little Coleman cooler that I put ice in, we actually used a cold pit plate and we buried it at the bottom of their cold well. So being a bar, of course, they have a place where they're getting ice for their drinks, and this was a really easy way to get that the cooling effect. I still had my bucket to serve as a reservoir to push the water through the to provide the water to push through the cold plate, but it worked out really well that way. And then, as you saw in the Great British Beer Festival, they actually build a temporary cellar, a temporary cold room in a huge venue space like this. So they'll have a bunch of different cold boxes. And then Craft Brewers Conference 2010, we had that NARAC setup, so 5 bays of stillage, 75 different firkins on cask. You have 2 hours to set it up, 3 hours to serve it, 1 hour to break it down. The only way that that was possible was to do the entire thing rack bright on a massive scale. And that's how we pulled that one off. All right, so how can you do cask ale? Make real ale. You're already doing it. Keep up the good work. I like to start small. Those 5-liter mini kegs that I mentioned, certainly great. The tilted corny keg is an option. Not a huge fan myself, but you guys can figure out the logistics of doing that. Or as a club or as people who are really interested in cask ale, get a couple of people to go in and buy some of that pricier gear. Another thing you could do is go big. Just go whole hog, get the really good equipment, the stainless steel pins, the beer engines, all the expensive stuff, and have little festivals. Especially if you enjoy nonprofit status, you're allowed to charge for the experience of the cask ale festival and just take any revenue and reinvest that in your gear. That's how NARAX went from a four firkin back bar thing 19 years ago to our massive 5-bay stillage that we enjoy these years. How to prime cask ale, this little technical stuff. Just like doing your bottle conditioned beer, it's all about how much sugar you're putting in it. So we do a little calculation using this chart here. Your fermented beer already has a little bit of residual CO2. We're just trying to bump it up to 1.4 dissolved volumes. So you do a math. 1.4 minus however much is still in the beer, that's how much CO2 you need. Then you add a little bit of dextrose based on this formula. That 0.59 is not random. That has a whole bunch of really neat chemistry behind it involving molecular weight and carbons and converting to CO2. I did the math once. I can't do it for you on site here. I don't remember. It was a few months ago. And then just like doing your bottle and bucket, just sanitize it by boiling for a little bit and add it directly to your vessel, your cask. So here, again, start small. When you're using these 5-liter mini kegs, I really like to use the 2-piece bungs. These over here, these are called your spiles, I've mentioned a few times. They're just little wooden pegs, and it pushes this middle part of the 2-piece bung out, and then it's just like working with the official pins and firkins. It's just a very small way to start. You can also go with the poly pin option. It certainly works. The way you use a poly pin is you fill it with beer, just like you know how to do with filling a firkin or anything with your homebrew stuff. But you serve it, you set the pin up so that the spout is actually at the top. Let the beer carbonate, and then to vent the beer, you open the spout, allow that headspace gas to come out and the beer to start to settle, close the tap, and then you gently rotate the whole thing 90 degrees. It allows all the yeast that settled on the bottom to kind of make a little pile in the back of the poly pin. And then you just serve the beer out of the spout and the pin the vessel collapses as you're serving. So that's another option for you. The basic gear I recommend, I'm a huge fan of pins. It's almost scaled to homebrew size, so I love using that. Probably every other month or so I do a pin. Your woody bits, those are your keystones, your shives, your hard spile, and then your reusable gear such as the dead blow hammer, the gravity tap, and also the chocks, the way that you're holding the beer still. And here they are in pitcher form, the hammer, the pin, that's your tap, that there's your keystone, looks like that. This is your shive, that's this larger one. This is a plastic version of it, that's a wooden one. They do the same thing. You'll notice it has that little depression in it. There's another one in this plastic one, and that's where you tap in your hard spile. That's this woody peg there. And then once you're all done serving, you pound your hard spile all the way in. That seals up your shive again. When you remove your tap, that's when you put in a bung. And that just seals it all up so that you can clean it at your leisure, which should be sooner rather than later, just like anything homebrew. Finally, you can go big. I wanted to let you guys know that I'm organizing a special group buy. I work with a couple different manufacturers of vessels and also beer engines. So if you guys would like to get in on it, I'm organizing this as a home brewer, not as a retail activity, so we can get the gear to you at hopefully pretty reasonable rates. And you can look that up on my website, homebrewcask.com. There's a whole section called Group Buy. And finally, if you want to learn more, while I was preparing my notes for this particular talk, I had so many notes that I decided, hey, what if I just put them in book form? So I also have a book that I wrote of the same title here, and you can pick that up from me after the talk, at the after the Q&A session. I'm just going to hang out in the lobby for a while. Just swing by anytime. Be happy to get that to you. You can also find it on homebrewcast.com or my little maydaycask.org website. But anyway, that's what I have to share with you today on hosting Cask Ale events. Hopefully you guys were able to get a little information out of me. And I suppose we'll open up for questions now. Thank you.
Randy, thanks for everything. A couple questions, technical. Our club, we actually have a beer engine that we built a stand for that actually is designed to fit a corner keg right in it, so we can take it to events.
Excellent.
And we're organizing a monthly meeting where one of the homebrew club members would actually brew a beer in a keg, bring it to the meeting, and then we serve it on the cask ale. And we've been doing that for a while, but we've had limited success, I should say. And so one thing I wanted to know, you didn't mention anything about it. What's your thoughts on using a spunding valve during the fermentation process to control the pressure?
I know some people use it. A spunding valve is just a way to allow a certain amount of CO2 out while keeping the headspace pressure pretty consistent. It's a great way to carbonate the beer without having to breach it and add more priming sugar.
Right.
Personally, I don't use them. I have a friend of mine who swears by them. So.
And what kind of pressure would you suggest setting it to if that were the case?
You'd have to look up on the CO2 temperature versus pressure chart.
Right.
For whatever the fermentation environment is, so that you're getting that 1.4 dissolved volumes in the beer naturally. You'd have to look that up.
Okay, two more quick questions. Yep. The keg itself, would you suggest that I just trim the dip tube just a little bit to just maintain the yeast bed down on the bottom?
Yep. Trimming the dip tube is an excellent idea. I have one of my kegs modified, the one that I do all of my Rack Bright stuff out of,
right.
So that I'm leaving that sediment behind. Another thing I did was, this is one of the kegs that has the straight liquid side dip tube. It doesn't curve towards the bottom. And I actually put one of the racking cane tips on it, the little black device, so that I'm not sucking off the bottom. It's to the side and above that point. So, yes,
great.
Absolutely.
And the last question, because we try to keep things simple for whoever's doing it, so they're not having to do all the formulas and everything. That 0.59 figure that you had, as a general rule, I've been telling the guys to use a quarter to a third of the normal sugar that they would use if they were bottling. Is that a good estimate of a number?
That's a great number, using that quarter amount.
Okay.
When I ferment, I don't have any fancy fermentation chamber or anything, so it's just room temperature in my living room. So the beer is about 70 degrees, holds on to about 0.8 dissolved volumes, and to get up to the 1.4 myself, I use about 1.25 ounces. So it's exactly what you're saying, that quarter of
great, so we've been
ounces.
Doing it right there.
Yeah. Sounds like you're doing great. Keep up the good work.
You said last night that you tried five or six different cask ales, and I'm sure you've been to other homebrew festivals where people have had them. What are some of the things that people are doing right, and what things do you see are common mistakes that people are making on the homebrew level with casks?
Well, I'm just really enthusiastic that anyone's trying to get the cask out there at events like these, so I consider any homebrew cask to be done to be a good thing. Usually what you run into are problems with clarity, because especially in an event like this, you allow the yeast to carbonate the beer in the pin, and then you hand it off to the cellar team here. They do a great job, but they're primarily focused on serving kegged beer. They don't have that same experience with cask. So they give you back your cask with 1 hour to set it up, and it's all sorts of mixed up. It's been twisted this way and that. It's not going to settle very quickly. So for these kind of events, like what I did in Philadelphia 2 years ago, was the day before we left, and we were fortunate enough to be close enough that I could drive down, all the beer was Rack Bright, so the cellar team could do whatever it does, and the beer still shows up in good condition. So really trying to employ strategies to minimize the yeast-involved haziness of the cask beer, I think is what homebrewers should focus on for making good good cask beer out when they're out and about. So, yes.
Cool. Thanks for the talk. I have a pin, and every August I have a IPA day party, mm-hmm. first Thursday. And I have a pin on tap, and then I have other beers on tap. But sometimes I have problems with carbonation, or I'd like more carbonation. I've seen the packets of yeast that the local homebrew designated, they're specifically
CBC
for.
CBC yeast, the cask and bottle conditioning yeast that
yeah.
you're talking about.
So have you ever tried that? I know there's yeast in there, mm-hmm. but would that add more, or do I not really care?
It depends how long the beer has been aging. As part of a typical fermentation, you're dealing with 2 or 3 weeks. There's plenty of yeast in solution. You don't need to worry about it.
Okay.
But if you're doing like a barley wine or an old ale, something that's been sitting for a long time, adding that cask and bottle conditioning yeast is a great idea.
Okay. And then one more question. Soft spile. Do mm-hmm. you ever, I soft spiled it 2 days in advance. I didn't. Do you do this often, Hart?
As you might have picked up, I'm not a huge fan of soft spiles. I didn't include them in the presentation here. What a soft spile is it is a slightly different form of wood that allows excess gas to migrate through while still keeping the vessel relatively sealed. And soft spiles can be used during service, so as you're dropping the volume of beer out, it allows gas in and also serves as kind of a coarse filter. Personally, I don't use them. I just use a hard spile.
And you hard spile it right before you serve it?
Yep.
Okay.
So tap in the hard spile to open up the port, and then I pull it out to allow for service.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
This is related to service. So I'm comfortable with the Franconi and Gravity kegs and the regular pins and stuff. But for our tasting room, they've picked up a beer engine for us for CBC. And the intent, it seems to be, is to put we have the IPA in a stout, that they want to put it in our regular keg box and feed through there. But that's a temperature of 38 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any concern about that in regards to the experience of that and drawing it through our short draw into the beer engine?
Well, the much colder temperature is going to mute a lot of those malty flavors that I love in cask-conditioned beer. And, well, it's nice that you're serving it at the lower carbonation, which is appropriate. Serving it that cold just doesn't work for me. I don't think the person that gets the beer is going to get the full experience of what you're trying to put in that cask. There's at least one bar in the Harvard Square area of Boston, and they have essentially a mini fridge, and they can fit a firkin in there on end, and they have a caskage in there, and they just adjust the temperature up. It's just like making a fermentation chamber for a homebrew batch.
Okay. That sounds great, because I think that the idea is to make it be able to last more than, say, multiple dates, which, several sessions.
So to make the beer last a little longer, what you want to do is they have a device called a name's escaping me. It's just like the CO2 regulator. You're blanking it, mm-hmm. blanketing it with CO2. You don't get the experience of the beer aging a whole lot in the cask. There's still some oxygen in there just from the brewing process, so that helps a little bit. But one of the advantages of putting a cask breather is what they're called. And that prevents the beer from going stale before you have an opportunity to serve it. So while I don't mind cask breathers, but I know that the chairman of Camera would kick me out of the organization because he believes they are the devil. Cask breathers certainly work to preserve the beer and allow you to serve it for longer than that typical 3-day window.
Great. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else need to ask a question? Anyone?
Well, if I could share a few more words with you guys. You guys are home brewers. You have the same spirit of innovation that I love and enjoy. I've seen a lot of really interesting homebrew-style casks. So even though I'm a fan of those English-style session ales, don't be afraid to throw a Pesh in a pin. The last Mayday Cask Festival, you run that as kind of a People's Choice Awards. The winner 2 years ago was that was a mild, but this past year it was a Flanders Red that people really loved. So even though it's not a traditional thing that you would see in cask, don't be afraid to throw it in. Some of them are going to fall a little flat. I wouldn't put a Guza on cask. But I know one of the commercial breweries in New Hampshire does an absolutely delightful Berliner Weiss on cask. So, anyway.
Yeah, I was wondering about dry hopping cask beers.
I'm a huge fan of dry hopping casks. I prefer to use the whole hops as opposed to pelletized hops. The whole hops just help to settle on the little filter built into the tap, and it kind of pre-filters the beer as it comes out. Pretty much anything you like, you can do it. Myself, I'm not a huge hop head, so I prefer to use about a half an ounce as my dosing rate. I've seen commercial brewers stuff 4 ounces of whole hops into a firkin to dry hop it with. Absolutely. And if you'll forgive me for the hard sell here, in the book I have a table of it's an incomplete list of hops and their aromatic qualities. So I don't pay any attention to the alpha acid range. It's only looking at the aromatic flavors and qualities that you're getting out of the hop. And it's available online for free, so you can go to the Mayday Cask website and find it there somewhere. I think I put a link to it. But anyway, say you want to do something like a Topaz hop, which just came out, but you can't get it at your local shop, you can look up Topaz hop and have it pop up with piney and citrus, if that's part of the descriptor, and then research the entire table using pine as one of your search terms. And that'll pop up a bunch of other hops that'll get you in that same direction. So yeah, absolutely, dry hopping is a great way to flavor a cask. So yeah, thank you all for coming out today. This has been really terrific.